Hello, and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I am Cy Kellett, your host, joined this time by Joe Heschmeyer, and we're going to talk about a somewhat difficult topic for Christians to discuss, one in which we have a very mixed history and therefore some things to regret, but not all things to regret. And it's not a simple conversation. That's what makes it difficult too. That is anti-Semitism and the Catholic Church, anti-Semitism and the Christian worldview, anti-Semitism and Christian people. There's relationships here to all of these things, but the relationships are not always what they seem, and they are difficult to parse, require some subtlety, and this is not, especially given the horrific treatment of Jews over the last 100 years, it's not a subject in which careful parsing is always available to us. So we'll give it a try today. We'll see how we do. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure.
This topic comes up because more and more we see, well, the internet just bearing more fruits for yes. all of us. You know, this, the endless fruits of the internet. Among them is a growing assertion that in order to be Catholic, you really got to be against the Jews.
Yeah, there's variations of that, but there's kind of a theme of that. And it's not, obviously, it's not coming from the top down. It's not like Pope Francis is saying, hey guys, be more hateful against the Jews.
We've really loosened up too much on the Jews here.
No. It's not that. It's from strange corners of the internet. And, you know, but people are often
well-populated corners of the internet.
It's hard to know how well-populated. You know, it's hard to know how many people are enthusiastically.
Right.
But there does seem to be a rising tide of anti-Semitism, anti-Judaic kind of views.
And there is a kind of thing where the person wants to be orthodox in, with the little o, you know, the person mm-hmm. who comes to the point in their life where they're, I believe in Jesus, I believe he's the founder of this church. I want to be as faithful to what it really teaches and what he really teaches as I can. So they end up having to question lots of things in the light of that conversion. So I don't know, my relationship with capitalism, my relationship with, if I'm a man with women, if I'm a woman with man, you know, my relationship with all kinds of things. So clearly there is a long, long history of both good and bad relations between Catholics and Jews. Mm-hmm. So where am I supposed to fall on that? So I do think that there's a kind of reasonable question of, how am I supposed to be an Orthodox Catholic? That's a good question to ask.
It is.
But it gets hijacked.
Well, yeah. Well, and I think you've tapped into something that people want to be radically Catholic.
That's it. That's it, Joe. That's it. Right. Right down to the root.
That's good, right?
Yeah.
Like, you should be radically Catholic, but you should just watch out for radicalism for its own sake.
Yeah.
Being radically Catholic doesn't mean you have to support a radical political ideology. It doesn't mean you have to support radical ideas about race or about Jewish people or about any of those things. And in fact, being radically Catholic is incompatible with most forms of everything I just mentioned there. That, you know, that you can't be radically following Jesus Christ and radically following some secular ideology or some hatred or some whatever. You know, you have to serve either Jesus or Caesar.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess that idea of this growing very positive idea of wanting to be radically Catholic and then questioning everything in the light of that, the question in people's mind is not, does the church give me permission to be an anti-Semite? Mm. Because I don't think people are I shouldn't say that. Some people are looking for that permission. But I don't think that that's the common reason. What people are asking is, does the church require me to be an anti-Semite? Like, because – look, 2,000 years, lots of things written and said by Catholics, mm-hmm. lots of actions taken by Catholics.
Yes.
Looking back, that are anti-Jewish and in many cases even anti-Semitic. So, what's tradition, in other words, am I supposed to appropriate here?
Yeah.
Am I required to appropriate?
Right, right. Because I think there's a sense of wanting to be faithful, not just because when you say, does the church require or permit me to be anti-Semitic? If you listen to anything any living Catholic bishop or priest in good standing is saying, they're going to say very clearly, no, this is totally incompatible with being Catholic. But as you said, you go digging in the history and you can find plenty of anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish comments made by prior generations of Catholics, including sometimes saintly Catholics. I mean, St. John Chrysostom has some homilies that he preaches against the Jews that were really uncomfortable to read in the 21st century.
Right.
And so that's all there. And so people say, well, I don't want to just jettison uncomfortable Catholic teachings. And that's a good impulse. But this is never an official church teaching. This was the prejudices and kind of bigotries of a former generation. And you are not inclined to, you're not forced to repeat your father's sins. You know, if you go back, the prior generations were not just perfect golden ages for the church, for Christianity, for the simple reason that original sin exists. Yeah. Every generation has sinners. And every generation seems to have its own maybe frequent sins. You know, you don't have to bring back dueling just because prior generations of Catholics kind of turned a blind eye to the immorality of dueling. They allowed these things to happen. Well, that was wrong. You don't have to burn witches. You don't have to – you know what I mean? Like there, you go back in the history and
you don't have to burn witches?
You don't have to.
Sorry, it's just a joke, Joe.
Yes. But we'll have to do another episode now.
Now on witches, yes.
But the point is, like, every generation, you go back to 2,000 years, there's a billion people in Catholicism right now. You're looking at the lives of innumerable people. And many of them are going to have views that are wrong or views that we can now look back on in a new light and say, you know what? I don't think they got that one right. Yeah. And this is on a lot of issues, you know. Even St. Thomas Aquinas saying women are misbegotten men. He's repeating the best science of his day. It's Aristotle.
Right.
But now we wouldn't say, oh, we have to believe in this really obviously false vision of men and women.
Right, right.
And we could even say there's something in that vision that it's more obvious today is incompatible with the Christian vision of Genesis. That women aren't just like a mistake in nature.
No, right. Okay.
They're part of God's design. So the light of Christ should be something we hold up both to our own generation and all of the things we get wrong and to past generations and things that our forebears got wrong. We don't have to just repeat those things because they're old.
In the middle part of the 20th century, a lot of stuff changed in the Catholic Church. And I do think part of this reevaluation is what did we get right and what did we get wrong in all of that change?
Yes.
And one of the things that changed was the church's attitude towards Jews. I won't say the church's teaching because I don't know about that, but certainly the attitude after the Holocaust, I think it became clear to many in the church, certainly Pope John Paul II, that while the church hadn't taught anti-Semitism, the church had been
too hospitable.
Very fertile ground for fans. Let's put it that way. It had been fertile ground for anti-Semitism.
And it is a nuanced story that, you know, there have been instances where popes spoke out against, where they tried to help the Jewish populations. You know, even like, for instance, the building of Jewish ghettos in Rome was a controversial thing where was this something that was helpful to Jewish people by protecting them from their Christian neighbors?
Right.
Was it something that hurt? You know, there's often really complicated nuanced discussions.
Right. But for the Jews themselves, they didn't want to be in a ghetto.
You know, St. Casimir in Poland was considered really good towards the Jews. And this is, you know,
well, this is why there were so many Jews in Poland.
I mean,
the Polish Christianity was traditionally, from about the year 1000 on, was very open to Judaism. It didn't have the same
vitriol,
which is so sad for the Polish people today that they're, you know, people think, well, the Holocaust was committed in Poland, therefore it was a Polish crime. It's not.
A lot of the Poles were in the camp alongside the Jews.
Yeah. So, in Poland, we have a thousand years of a better example than in much of the rest of the church.
And so that's to say the church's history with this is really nuanced in every age, where you have good and bad figures. You've got people who have very kind of backwards views, and you have people who have very enlightened views on this issue. So it is – but I think it's fair to say, writ large, there were way too many times and places in which the church was hospitable to these noxious and anti-Jewish ideas.
I know a woman. She grew up in the Bronx back in the early part of the 20th century. She's passed now. I knew her. And she told me that for fun on Good Friday, coming home from Catholic schools, kids would throw rocks at the synagogue saying, "You killed the Jews." And they weren't trying to start a pogrom or something.
Right.
Like, this was just, you know, part of being in the Bronx, that the Italians were known for this, the Irish were known for that. But the Jews on Good Friday, it was funny to throw rocks at the synagogue. That's not even 100 years ago.
No,
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, I do.
That's very recent.
Yeah. If you've ever been to Wittenberg in Germany, you see a much older example of this. On the parish church there, there's a really offensive anti-Jewish depiction of a Jewish farmer with a pig. And pigs are completely forbidden. So it's a mocking kind of thing. And after the church became Lutheran, they added the unspeakable name of God above it just to make it more sacrilegious. This is engraved on the church.
Oh, Lord. Wow.
It's shocking. Like, yeah. It's shocking kind of stuff. And you just think, okay, that's worse than the teenage shenanigans. The teenage shenanigans are bad.
Yeah, yeah.
But something like this is just like, that's become institutionalized in a real way. That generation after generation of churchgoer saw this and thought, we'll leave that up there. Yeah. And it's still there today. Now, right. After the Holocaust, there was a move to remove it. And actually, Jewish leaders spoke out and said, no, we think you should keep it.
Yeah, see why.
Yeah.
Because
people should know this was here. So now there's a little marker and everything explaining why it's still there.
Right.
But, it's shocking. It is a shocking kind of testament. So someone, who grew up, as I did, in the middle part of the country where there isn't a long history of strong anti-Jewish sentiment, partly because there isn't a long history of there being a large Jewish population in the first place.
Right.
This can feel like a very strange and foreign history, but this is part of our story as Catholics.
Yeah.
And you're right. This is not just a long ago sort of story, that you can find this stuff much more recently.
Okay. So in the middle part of the 20th century, so much changes in the Catholic Church. A lot of that change is, in fact, a consequence of the Second World War and the Holocaust.
Yeah. Although I might add that we see this change. Sorry to interrupt, but I want to make something really clear here. Pius XI, who is writing before the Holocaust, sees the direction this is going.
Oh, yes.
And,
right. I see
really
what you're saying. Yeah.
Effectively calls it out well before there even is a Holocaust.
Yeah.
I mean, at least a few years before the Holocaust begins.
Well, Jews were being harassed, brutalized, and in some cases killed, but the mass killing hadn't started
yet.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And so, for instance, in September of 1938, he says, "Mark well that in the Catholic Mass, Abraham is our patriarch and forefather. Anti-Semitism is incompatible with the lofty thought which that fact expresses. It is a movement with which we Christians can have nothing to do. No, I say to you, it is impossible for a Christian to take part in anti-Semitism. It is inadmissible. Through Christ and in Christ, we are all the spiritual progeny of Abraham. Spiritually, we are all Semites."
And this is when? What year would this
September
have been?
September 6, 1938.
Okay, so 1938. You don't say something like that in that context without that being a direct confrontation with Nazis.
Not only Nazis, but earlier in 1938, Mussolini had given his Aryan Manifesto. Now, Mussolini, as someone wrote in to point out to me, actually had a much better track record on killing Jews than did Hitler.
And the Italian military.
Right.
Even better than Mussolini's.
Right. Yes. And so the Germans end up invading Italy because they're not being an eager enough partner in the Holocaust.
Right.
But despite that, there is still this stirring up of anti-Semitic sentiment. And you have this pro-Aryan thing going on in Italy as well as in Germany. And I think the church leaders recognize this is something new and alarming, certainly the degree and the violence of it. And so pretty famously, Pius XI also releases the only papal encyclical written in German, Mit brennender Sorge, which means it is with deep anxiety. And it's on the trajectory of things in Germany. And again, he writes this before the Holocaust. And he writes this actually in March of 1937. So even before the other part that I read, just warning about anyone exalting race, that they're making a god of it, that this is something that only an idiotic kind of mind could imagine a purely national or racial God, that it's not faithful to who Jesus is as a Semite to be anti-Semitic. Like, to hate people of Jewish blood would mean hating your Savior. It means hating Mary. It means hating the apostles. Yeah. It's absurd. And so he calls out the absurdity of this and just that general trajectory.
I believe the Nazis claimed Jesus was not a Semite, right?
They
just removed that.
They did a couple things. They tried to co-opt Christianity. which, you know, make a national kind of Christian church.
Right.
They also started to try to revive Norse paganism and other kind of like Germanic paganism, those things, because you don't have to have any of the Jewish stuff.
No, it's not right. It's not there at all because the Jews hadn't reached right. there yet.
And so there's yeah. actually something that I find strangely comforting about that, that for all their attempts to co-opt Christianity, at the end of the day, they realized you just can't be Christian and a Nazi. So let's get rid of this Christianity thing.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. so that's good. It's like, well, the Nazis get it. Now, yeah. if the Christians could just get, you can't be Christian and a Nazi, then we'd be all set.
Right. Exactly. Right. Now, okay. So, a very helpful discursus, but here we are, the middle of the 20th century, everything changes. Mm-hmm. Not everything, but it has that feeling of everything right, changes. Right. So people want to do an authentic go back before that. It's very helpful that you point out that Pope Pius XI,
right.
So still a Catholic pope, according to everyone, I think. Yeah.
Let's explain that comment, because I think that yeah. actually is important.
Okay.
Because a lot of the anti-Semitic stuff is closely tied with a deep suspicion and sometimes outright rejection of all the popes from John the 23rd on.
Right.
And so someone who believes the last valid pope was Pius the 12th can look at all this stuff that is very like openly anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Very much like, here are all the good things the Jewish people have. Very much embracing the legitimacy of the fact that God has not forgotten these people that he called. And they look at that and say, that's just proof these aren't the real popes. Well, you can't pull that move with Pius the 11th because he's before Pius the 12th. That's yeah. right there in the number.
Yeah.
And so I think it's worth pointing out, like, there's a reason I'm going before the war, before the Second Vatican Council, before all these things, because it doesn't allow the easy cop out of like, oh, well, that was just, yeah. you know, Catholic guilt after the war, or
this is that some was just modernist this invalid. Pope.
Right, right, yeah. exactly.
Yeah, well, kind of tolerance, it does seem to me that there's a tolerance of anti-Semitism. There's a very bad record of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. We don't want to, and so there's a temptation to see that as the valid tradition.
Yeah.
Okay, so because you have popes who and bishops and who insist on Jews in the ghettos, and there's the whole history of the translation of the Talmud into Latin, and kind of a shock in the Christian world that what this is what the Jews think of us, and there was this back mm-hmm. which all taps into a much earlier suspicion of the Jews, because now tell me if I get my history wrong about the Roman Empire, but it. The Jewish religion had a special place in the Roman Empire, in large part because of good relations between Jews and certain Roman emperors. So the Jews have a special position in the Roman Empire. Christians are not permitted, once Christians are seen as a different religion from the Jews, are not permitted the privileges that Judaism is permitted.
Yes.
So there's this... For the early church, there's a sense that they have a sense of grievance against Jewish leaders, because Jewish leaders themselves are leaving these Christians, are more or less pushing them out of the privileged place they would have had they been recognized as Jews. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. You see that even in the first century.
Yeah,
you know, like the Sanhedrin has an actual legal standing that the Jewish leadership in Roman Palestine
yeah.
actually has some authority. Now, they're still a subjugated people, but they have official recognition. And then in response to Christianity, you do find Jewish leaders who cooperate with the Romans in turning Christians in, because they're saying, oh, these guys are heretics. They don't belong with us. And understandably, from the Jewish perspective, they're hearing these guys believe in a Messiah. This could bring down the wrath of the Roman Empire upon us. You actually get this in the Gospel of John, in John 11. When the Sanhedrin's deliberating, one of the things they're afraid of is this is going to be seen as a political movement, and the Romans are going to take all those privileges away and start being a lot harsher to the Jews, because the Jewish people stood up so strongly in favor of monotheism that they refused to worship the Roman gods. Everybody else has to worship the Roman gods. The Jews get a pass because they just weren't going to do it. And it's actually, in a lot of ways, a testament to the fidelity of Israel.
Sure,
that
right.
All, we talk so much about the infidelity of Israel, but compared to all the neighbors,
yeah,
Israel's doing a great job.
Right.
They're not just giving up their local gods and going to worship the Roman gods. You know, the Israel saying, no, no, we have the one true God of the universe, and he's above Caesar, and we're going to follow him. And so we'll pay taxes, but we're not going to worship your God.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to go even farther back then,
yeah,
all the way to the writing of the Gospel of John. I think it's in the Gospel of John that Jesus says salvation is from the Jews.
It is.
And then the rest of the Gospel of John, you don't want to be sitting with your Jewish friends when they're reading it. I mean, you have a visceral feeling of, man, the word Jews is used so negatively,
mm-hmm,
in this gospel.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I think there's something to that. But it, again, we're reading that with 21st century eyes or ears.
Yeah.
With a very fresh recollection of the Holocaust.
Sure. Yeah.
And we're reading it as non-Jews. And the same way that, you know, an American can write a song about an American intervention abroad, and no one's like, oh, are you racist against Americans? Because no, obviously not. Like,
I see.
It's criticizing from inside the house,
right,
in a different way. And so you can speak a little more freely in a little more of an unnuanced way because you can assume a little more nuance. And so the Gospel of John is centered around the Jewish liturgical calendar. It's a deeply Jewish book.
Right.
When you look at what event is going on, it's one Jewish holiday after another.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so read it in those eyes, and you realize that when John talks about the Jews, he doesn't mean in an unnuanced kind of way every Jewish person. He doesn't mean Jesus as a Jew.
Right.
He means specifically the Judean leadership.
Yeah.
And the word Jew means Judean. And the Judean leadership puts Jesus to death. Just like we can say the Romans put Jesus to death. And we don't mean every citizen of Rome, every member of the Roman Empire, anything like that. We are referring with a shorthand to a specific elite, a specific group of people who are the actors,
yeah,
at a particular time and place. And so when we talk about this, and so bringing this back to the throwing rocks at the synagogue on Good Friday kind of example,
right,
the biggest cop-out here is saying that the Romans and the Jews did this. And it's like, no, no, I did this through my sin. That there's, yeah, the two things that get left out theologically in that kind of cop-out of just blaming the Jews or blaming the Romans is, first, that Jesus says, no one takes my life from me, I freely lay it down, John 10. So John is actually very clear about this. This is not just a Jewish conspiracy. But second, that this is a response to our sin. And this is very clear from John 3, you know, God so loved the world that he sent his only son. Why does he have to send him? Well, because of the story of sin, because of the story of us turning away from him. And so when we lose those two dimensions, that Jesus is the priest of this offering on the cross, and this offering is made because of the sins of the entire world, not just one religion, one ethnicity, one sect, one anything, but everyone. If you lose that, you've actually lost the whole story. You've missed the big picture of what Good Friday is actually all about.
Okay, so I appreciate that and I agree with it, but we're stuck with this accusation that the Gospel of John is anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I think it's not. I think it's a deeply Semitic book.
Right.
I think when it's read outside of its Jewish context, It can easily be misread in that way.
Yeah.
There are particular passages, you know, when the crowd says, his blood be upon us and our children. Aha. You know, you can leap on
that's
those.
A blood curse that they put on themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. But it's like, well, no, what is it?
And, what does that
and
actually
Benedict
mean?
XVI points out, well, for the blood of Jesus to be on them, they're actually calling down a blessing whether they know it or not.
Right. Yeah.
And may
that's
his
the
blood
irony.
Be upon
and
us
clearly, John means that too.
Right.
That he sees
right.
that as ironic.
Yes.
That, yeah.
And especially because, again, the Jewish liturgical context, he describes this as Preparation Day. He says this is, he uses that language. Well, what is Preparation Day? Well, it's the day you kill the Passover lamb and then you smear the blood on the doorposts. And so if the crowd's clamoring for the blood of Jesus to be on them and their children, and it's smeared on the wood of the cross, they're asking for the Passover lamb.
Yeah.
That's not a reason to curse anybody. It's like, well, read Exodus, and this story makes so much more sense. In other words,
yeah, I see what you're saying.
The problem with people reading the Gospel of John in anti-Semitic ways, they're missing the entire Jewish meaning of the Gospel of John.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just throw a 1960s analogy at it. You see what you think. In a certain point, I could have said the Americans illegally bombed Cambodia, or yeah. I could have said Washington.
Right.
Illegally bombed. And I would have known you're talking about the exact same thing.
Yeah, Washington I was actually Americans. Thinking of just something very similar. I was listening to Warren Zevon.
Yeah.
Talking about America invading Mexico with the siege of Veracruz. And he's an American. And so you don't think, oh, I bet this guy hates all gringos.
Right.
you listen to those words with a different understanding when you realize that it's someone in a group saying the Americans.
Yeah.
You know, an American saying the Americans did such and such means American leadership,
right.
The powers that be. And contextually, anyone kind of picks that up.
So when John says the Jews, would you—
He is a Jew. I mean, this is a critical detail.
But here's another critical detail. He's not a Jew from Jerusalem. He's a Jew from the Galilee.
Right.
Okay. So is there any possibility that what's being expressed here in the Gospel of John is a sense of peripheral Jews from the Galilee? Because you can see it all through John's gospel. Mm-hmm. The people from Galilee they stand out compared to the people from—
They got a weird accent.
Yeah, they're different. And all the gospels. Mm-hmm. So that in John's mind, when he's saying the Jews, he's talking about, like, if I were to say Washington has got another tax, you know.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying? He's talking about—
I think you can, but even there, when you say Washington, you don't mean even all the people of Washington, D.C.
No, right.
You mean the powerful elite. Now, you're right that there's a certain way people in the hinterlands talk about people in the center of power.
Yeah.
But in this case, John actually has a familiarity with the centers of power. Remember, he's able to go into the high priest's courtyard because he knows.
Right.
So even though he's an outsider by birth, he knows the people he's criticizing here.
Yeah.
This is not—
It's very intimate.
It is very intimate.
This is a very intimate.
Right.
It's almost a familial thing.
It's very different than like a Nazi who's never been friends of the Jew in his life saying, oh, the Jews, this, that, and the other, when it's just like a two-dimensional stereotype in their head. This is someone who is Jewish, who knows the high priest, saying a deep betrayal happened here.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. So then that's our travel down memory lane of the relationship. There's high points and there's low points. I mean, one of the things when you talk about, say, during the Crusades, the killing of Jews in Mainz in I don't know how they say it in German, but in American we say Mainz. You know, one of the things about that is they say they killed 10,000 Jews. Well, another part of that is there's 10,000 Jews in Mainz.
Yeah.
You know, like when we think of the late medieval conflicts. Well, we got to say, well, what happened that there's hundreds of thousands of Jews and Christians living together in Northern Europe and all across Europe?
Yeah.
That clearly there's positives in this relationship as well.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that to try to minimize, you know, it really bothers me that, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, Catholic kids were throwing rocks at synagogues and still do, you know, and still do. I'm not trying to minimize that. I'm just saying that there's a lot of untold positives in these relationships.
There has to be. Yeah, absolutely.
Or we wouldn't have lived together for 1,000 years.
But I think, let me go in a slightly different direction with that. Because I think one of the dangers, and I think I worry about this in some ways more as a universal problem than the specifics of anti-Semitism or being anti-Judaic. And by the way, the reason I distinguish that is anti-Semitism historically is like a 19th century kind of invention. It's hating the Jews based on ethnicity or on blood.
Whereas racism is very modern.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a natural suspicion of the other in the human being. But
the idea of race as opposed to ethnicity
is very modern idea.
And it's a very loose kind of idea. The idea that like pygmies and Ethiopians are all one people. It's actually very kind of simplistic.
Yeah.
I mean, even like, are Italians white? Ask someone 100 years ago and you're going to get a different answer than you would today.
Right.
The idea of race in general is a very loose and usually it's a very poor substitute for some other stand-in that's a little more real.
Right.
Ethnicity being one thing, culture being one thing. You know, that those ideas have a little more oomph to them where you can point to them a little more. There's still a little, you know, the boundaries are porous. But there's something there where you can say there is a culture here. There is an ethnicity. When you try to define race, it's loose.
Oh, very loose, yeah.
Right. But all that's to say, Leon Bloy called out anti-Semitism.
Who's Leon Bloy?
Leon Bloy, 19th and 20th century author. He was born in 1846, died in 1917. I discovered him through Pope Francis, who quoted him in his first homily as Pope. And then the line he quoted was really shocking. It was, "Whoever doesn't worship Christ worships the devil." And I thought, wow, that's wow.
That's stark.
Yeah. But Bloy actually was really a strong opponent of anti-Semitism. And he said, "Anti-Semitism, a quite modern development, is the most horrible buffet that our Lord has received in his passion, which is still going on. It is the most outrageous and the most unpardonable because he receives it on the face of his mother and from Christian hands."
It's a stunning quote.
Isn't that?
But it's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to hate Jews, you're going to hate Mary, the mother of Jesus? I mean, how far are we going with this?
Yeah. And so the other point I was going to make is this is tangential to that, but I gave that just to explain anti-Semitism is even a different history than anti-Judaism. But a lot of this is coming from the same place, particularly a lot of the anti-Jewish stuff, which is Christians and Jews lived alongside of each other for centuries, and these Jews weren't converting to Christianity.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of reasons for that. But the easiest lie to tell yourself is, well, it's not that I'm not converting. It's not because of my bad example or my bad witness. It's not for any of the positive things they're finding in Judaism. It's just because they're bad people.
Yeah.
And right. I mention this because I think we can do that. Maybe not the Jews. Maybe that's not the group that you're inclined to do that with. It can be the liberals, the non-Catholics, whatever, you know, whoever it is, where you just say, oh, yeah, well, they are these kind of two-dimensional villains. They are not like me with an intellect and a will that's drawn to truth and goodness. They've got a different kind of composition. And so now I can explain why they haven't converted.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's and in a certain sense, there's a certain pressure to explain the Jews because they're it's a weird thing to say, Joe, but they're so much like Christians.
Yes.
That you have to explain them away or else that's a threat to Christianity in a certain sense. Because here you have they have beautiful families. They pray to the one God. They have a wonderful liturgical life. And you go, well, that, like, if I say that's good, am I diminishing the uniqueness of Christianity? And I think there's a little insecurity in it that comes with that.
Well, I think we saw that on display when the church did say, hey, here are all these good things that are going on within Judaism. A fair number of Catholics freaked out and said, why would you say Catholicism isn't good? And it's like, well, they didn't say that. They didn't.
Right.
No one said Catholicism was bad. No one said Catholicism was incomplete even or that it didn't have more, you know, but just to acknowledge this good and this validity, it is a little bit of an insecurity. And again, I draw that back and say, when you realize your political opponent, you're the person of another political party or ethnicity or race. I mentioned political party just because I think that's the main one today more than the ethnic stuff. But whatever your hatred, your animosity, your fear is, that move of admitting maybe they've got something right, maybe they're on to something.
Yes.
Right. Is really worth kind of exploring the insecurity there. I mean, it's worth finding. I was just talking with Todd, our editor here, that I find it very helpful to see figures that I like on issues I think they're wrong because it lets me see them the way that people who disagree with them see them.
Yeah, and you can kind of practice.
Yeah, and you can see if they come off really haughtily and you kind of reevaluate them because when someone's being really smug and they agree with you, then you're just like, aha, they're being really, you know, funny about it.
I know, but they nailed it.
Right. But yeah. But when it's on an issue, you know they're wrong. Wow, they're actually more of a jerk than I realize. Well, the flip side to that
which means I'm more of a jerk than I realize.
Yeah, let's not explore that part too deeply.
Okay, yeah.
But no, of course. That's
always the case, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And you realize maybe I come off that way as well. There's kind of a triumphalism that's really fun to be a part of.
Right.
It comes off terribly poorly because it's very haughty. And the flip side to that is to find the people with whom you disagree and find an issue on which you agree with them and see how they articulate it. And just allow yourself to agree with someone you maybe struggle with. It's a concrete way to, if you want to call it loving your enemies, if you want to call it expanding your horizons, however you think of that,
right?
Finding those things. I bring that all back to this question of how we think of and treat the Jews. There are so many good things from a Christian perspective going on. And that was transparent for 2,000 years. But a lot of times Christians close their eyes to that because there is, I think, an insecurity in acknowledging this person is a fellow human. This is another son of Adam. This is another I. This is, you know, a person who values many of the same things I do. And yet here we are disagreeing about this very important issue of Jesus.
And that, and you're just going to have to sit with that, with the whatever difficulty that gives you, because it's you can't say that every good person is going to agree with me, even on the core of things. That's just not how being a human being works. But we want it to work that way.
We do. We want it to work that way. Yeah. And we want to make it very simplistic. You can find the good guys and the bad guys based on their views on whatever issue.
I didn't ask you about this, and I should have. In the history of anti-Semitism among Christians, we didn't talk about the person of Luther.
I thought about bringing up Luther, and I thought that would look like a deflection.
So that's okay. That's fine. Luther was a virulent anti-Semite.
He wasn't originally, though.
Oh,
and
he
I think
became.
He actually is a great embodiment of the thing I was talking about before. Early Luther is of the view that the reason the Jews still are Jewish, the reason they're not Christian, is because Catholics have corrupted the gospel. That if they just heard the simple, pure gospel, they would hear it and convert. Now, that is a biblically ignorant.
But what an interesting view,
though. It is an interesting view.
But I never knew that he held that view. Okay.
And so after he proclaims Lutheranism.
And they don't.
And they don't convert. He then says, well, I guess it's not that. I guess they're just horrible people. Yeah. And so we should kill their rabbis, burn their synagogues to the ground. And he has all sorts of really terrifying solutions that the Nazis then seize upon. And there really is a fairly clear line from Luther to the Third Reich. I mean, it's not that simple, but there is the Nazis are claiming to be doing what Luther called for. And they're promoting his work on the Jews and their lies is the name of it. And it's shockingly anti-Jewish. I mean, it is shockingly ugly. And from someone who not that long before had been much better. Zoom out and say the whole trajectory of Luther is he gets worse as he gets further from the Catholic Church. As a human being, he becomes worse and worse over his life.
I find that with myself, Joe.
Fair enough.
Whenever I get farther away,
it's true. But he becomes coarser. He becomes more offensive. He becomes more hateful. He is not growing in virtue in any discernible sense as he becomes more Protestant. I mean, regardless of what one thinks about his theology, even the most passionate Lutheran, just assessing the situation objectively, would have to say
he grew bitter.
Luther was just awful by the end of his life. And even other Lutherans like Melanchthon seemed to be pushing away from him and distancing themselves from him.
Okay. So as you said, we don't want to deflect. I mean, the truth is that the entirety of Christianity has a very complex and often negative history here. But I didn't want to leave it out because it is connected to the Holocaust. And
it is.
That's
well,
not
I think
to
it
blame
also
Lutherans
is
for the Holocaust or anything. I mean,
no, but I think in a lot of ways, Luther's trajectory there is very understandable. You just think, oh, if only someone presented this argument, then that person would convert. And then it could be the Jews, it could be atheists, it could be whoever. You just say, oh, if someone just presented it this way, I've got this amazing argument that'll really persuade the person. And they don't. And immediately that sense of defeat can come with a really defensive, oh, they're just a bad person. You know, because if they didn't listen to my argument and convert, that's something wrong with them.
Yeah, I gave them the simple, pure gospel.
And they
rejected it.
And there's a hubris there. There's a lack of understanding of the strange workings of grace. There's a lot of things going on there that I would just say watch out for, because I think that's one of the issues that has gone on historically in terms of Christian relations towards the Jews. I think it's something that happens in a wide variety of ways today.
All right. So I want to conclude just by asking you to, what should I say to the, and I don't want to focus on men here, but in my experience, it's young men, but it could very well be young women. And I just haven't listened well, but there is a kind of machismo, a macho anti-Semitism growing within the Catholic Church, and it does have to do with the desire to be radically obedient.
Yeah,
I think, but it and so it associates with traditions of the church, you know, like, I mean, lovely, beautiful traditions, simple traditions like women wearing veils and or the praying of the rosary or whatever. Mm-hmm. But also traditions that might be traditions of men. do you know what I'm saying? And among them, this anti-Semitism.
Oh, I see, yes.
So what do you say to the strong young man who wants to be manly in his Catholicism and he believes that that manliness requires a kind of confrontation with the Jews?
Yeah, I would say the great Christian insight in its confrontation with Rome was that humility wasn't a vice but a virtue, and that pride wasn't a virtue but a vice. And
yes,
if you go back and you look at Aristotle or the Romans, the Greeks before them, on virtue ethics, this is the one thing that the Greco-Roman world got wrong, is they thought of humility as bad and as pride as good. And they got a lot of other stuff right. And they were out on the money about prudence, temperance, fortitude, justice, and the like. Relatedly, there was the Roman virtue of magnanimity, being great-souled. And in the Roman world, this was the person who is amazing and knows they're amazing, and they throw their power and influence and money around, and they let the whole world see how great they are. And Christians responded to that by saying, yes, magnanimity is a virtue. It is a virtue to be great-souled. But the example isn't that guy. It's the martyr who gives of himself completely, who lays his life down entirely. Something like that is needed here.
Yeah,
that Christian greatness is not being as hateful as possible towards the Jews or towards anyone. It's of totally laying your life down. And true machismo, if you want to call it that, true manliness, true virtue, is this radical self-emptying that Christ exhibits. There was a line, I believe it was Mark Driscoll, the megachurch pastor, who was up in Seattle. If it wasn't him, I apologize. It was someone who was in that camp, who was kind of
someone
this macho, well, it's kind of this mega churchy, but macho evangelicalism.
Gotcha.
And he said he didn't want to worship any Jesus he could beat up.
Wow.
Neither and did the Romans. Like, yeah, well, I just thought, like, wait till you hear about the scourging at the pillar.
Good Lord.
It's like the whole point of Jesus is you can beat him up. The whole point of Jesus is that he allows himself to be trampled upon. I read someone who was attacking the Eucharist by saying, what a weak God that he can be stepped on in the Eucharist. Has to be, you know, covered with a humeral veil in the rain. It was like, well, wait till you meet Jesus in the manger.
Yeah.
This is a God who delights in weakness. If you get that about God, then this really like edgy, hateful, whatever attitude towards the Jews, it's just ridiculous. It's trying to pick up your sword when Jesus says, lay it down. And do that instead would be my counsel to anyone who's kind of drawn in that direction.
Joe Heschmeyer, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Hey, I know this might be one that gets us a lot of emails, and we welcome those emails. You can send your emails to focus@catholic.com, focus@catholic.com. Maybe there's things we didn't get into that you think we should have. Well, we're going to keep making these episodes as long as the Lord lets us. So if you got an idea, send it to us. If you got a suggestion, a critique, focus@catholic.com. Also, please give us money. It costs a little bit of money to do this, and if you'd like to support us financially, you can do that by going to givecatholic.com, givecatholic.com. As always, if you'd be kind enough, please give us that 5 stars and maybe a nice review wherever you listen to this podcast. That will help us grow. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.